Let me just find the right button to push. It's excellent.
Yep.
Ta-da! Technology is wonderful. Well, good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for the invitation to come and talk to you about loudspeakers. It's something that's been fairly close to my heart since I've been knee-high to a grasshopper. And I can remember playing around with 8-inch loudspeakers with field coils and vacuum tubes and all sorts of stuff that young kids shouldn't really, when you touch the wrong places you get zapped. So, but since then I've had 12 years at Philips, 25 years in TAFE teaching and managing electronics, and about the last 15 or 16 years working at Crick's Loudspeakers in Adelaide, mostly designing loudspeakers for commercial cinema, and I guess mostly designing acoustic horns, of which I've probably talked to you at some length about in previous occasions. This particular talk I think I might extend to loudspeaker design techniques, mostly cinema stuff with horns and things, but I guess I'll put in a little bit of the steps that you would also do if you were trying to design commercial hi-fi or, essentially the summary is this. I suppose a loudspeaker designer really should think about what size room the loudspeaker is going to be working in, and I'm not sure that too many of them do, especially in the home hi-fi, home cinema area. I mean, if you want a certain level of low frequencies, you need a certain volume velocity of cones to make that, and if you don't have them big enough, then it ain't going to work. Some sort of specifications about what sort of frequency response you want, whether it's flat or whether it's the dreaded X curve. Whole heap of stuff about beam angles, distortion, so on and so forth. Typical sorts of building blocks, system design, system integration, which is a flash word for designing crossovers, and some future directions and conclusions. As I think I said earlier, my main focus is commercial cinema, but the sort of steps I'm outlining would equally apply to home hi-fi and home cinema things. Certainly in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been considerable developments in materials, for cones, for magnets. Loudspeakers these days are a lot, individual loudspeaker drivers are a lot better animal than they were 15 years ago, certainly 20 years ago or even longer. And Mikhail Baravich here is contributing to the state of the art with some of his research and development and higher powers, less cone resonances and flexors and so on and so forth. My beef, I suppose, is that I've designed horn-loaded systems which sound like huge hi-fi systems, and then they go into a cinema and you get the crappiest soundtracks you could possibly imagine, which are just crashes and booms and telephone quality voices like this all the time. And I sit back there and I wonder, why did I do this? And so I've had, at one of the previous AS conventions, they did a workshop on cinema sound, and I stood up and had my bit of, complaining about the poor quality of cinema sound and when is it going to be improved. And I think that was parallel with some moves by some other people, some movers and shakers, to try and get the whole SMPTE standard or the AS standard revised and upgraded. And so as a result, there's now an AS technical committee, of which I've put my hand up to be a member. It's chaired by a guy called Brian McCarty, who runs Coral Sea Studios up in Cairns, but has spent 25 years in LA doing film sound and stuff. And it's got quite a few luminaries like Floyd Tuttle and Keith Holland and a couple of Pommy guys anyway who do studio design and stuff. And they had one meeting, I think, a preliminary meeting in San Francisco last year, a meeting in Budapest this year. There's been a SMPTE technical committee meeting as well. And for some reason, I don't know why the SMPTE people are under an oath of confidence not to disclose what they said in the SMPTE committee meeting to the AS committee meeting. So it could be that we're doing the rounds in a bit more bureaucratic snarls before we finally get some useful work done. But at the forthcoming AS conference in San Francisco, convention in San Francisco, they're having a whole workshop session on cinema sound, including from people who design the sound, as well as some of the technical considerations for the loudspeakers, and a bit of a few gurus together to talk about all the whole multi-channel sound stuff, like ISONO and Dolby have got this Atmos system they're trying to develop, and a few other people are trying, NHK have got their 22.2 system. So there's a few things in the melting pot, and what actually comes out of that will be rather interesting. Anyway, I digress. Essentially.
You have to take questions.
Yeah.
I was aware of Thomas and Holland's work at the end of the 80s.
Yes. Yeah, his was more aimed at home cinema, although he did set up some THX standards for commercial cinema as well, yes. But they were still pretty minimal.
Right.
I mean, looking at some of the stuff that's got THX approved, you sort of wonder how it got through. I mean, the whole idea was to try and make speakers that could play loud enough without rattling and buzzing, that the cinema screen was bright enough so you could actually see it, that were enough acoustic damping in the cinema so that you didn't get slap echoes everywhere. And I mean, that's a fairly cavalier summary of the THX standards. But you sort of get the idea. I mean, you've got to proceed slowly because there's a huge investment in existing cinemas and existing speaker technology. The current rage, of course, is to have digital projectors and file servers and all this sort of business. So cinema owners are now spending all their money going digital rather than trying to improve the sound systems. And improving the acoustics seems to be just so far down the end of the pecking order that it's unreal. There was a local cinema that I think we put our four ways in Adelaide, and they didn't sound too flash, and so I went behind the screen and looked, and you're supposed to have like this much fiberglass padding on the back wall. All this had was a curtain. It's supposed to be fiberglass padding down the side walls, and they had a bit of fiberglass and then a few curtains, and that was it. And so surprise, surprise, the room acoustics weren't too flash, and surprise, surprise, my speakers didn't sound too flash. But we won't know many names. So yes, I mean, that's the sort of thing that happens, unfortunately. However, to get back to what I was talking about, essentially, there's a fair variety of sizes and shapes of rooms. The IEC room is about 80 cubic metres or thereabouts, and supposedly golden ratio proportions, although, not golden ratio, but there are ratios you certainly avoid when you're trying to design a listening room, and a cube is one of them, and a 8 metres by 4 metres by 2 metres would be another one, you know, even multiples of dimensions and stuff like that. And then, of course, cinemas get considerably larger, 30 metres square, 14 metres high. Okay, they'd have rake seats, so it would be a little bit less high at the back, but you're still talking a considerable volume of air into which you've got to try and make low-frequency sound for the low-frequency effects and subwoofers and things. So you need a fair bit of acoustic energy for some of the larger sizes and systems. And SPL, it would be rather nice if you could get 100 dB in your home listening room, although I suspect that's beyond the capability of pretty well all domestic systems except the very expensive ones. Commercial Dolby and commercial cinema Dolby and THX want 103 dB peak level at two-thirds of the way back. Line-up level is 20 dB below that at 83 dB or thereabouts. And it's useful to remember that you double the distance, you lose 6 dB. 10 times the distance, you lose 20 dB. So for a hi-fi speaker, for example, if you had a 90 dB, 2.8 volts, 4 ohms, like these ones up here, for example, it could make 100 dB only out to 2.4 metres, which is not quite to the audience yet. So if you try to make realistic sound pressure levels out of these, I suspect they'd catch fire. But it would be interesting for a while. And commercial cinema, at least, stuffed with, you know, double 15s in a box and a few hundred watts of dissipation, can make 100 and something dB out to 18 metres or thereabouts, and that's usually the two-thirds distance of even fairly large cinemas. Dolby, I mean, you can get a whole lot more complicated about calculating SPL by trying to use room reverberation and all that sort of stuff. Dolby have a fairly simple formula, they say. Speech has got P's and T's and plosives in it. You hear the direct sound out of those, and the reverb of the room adds hardly any to that. So if you can't make the peak, the dB that's required with the direct sound, go away, you know, rather than to rely on a couple of extra dB of room reverberation and gain and stuff like that. So it also makes it pretty simple to calculate too, because you just do the inverse square law from where the speakers are out to where the audience is. And really, that's the sort of thing that I've got a little spreadsheet that does all this sort of stuff, which I can show you if you like. You put the dimensions of the cinema in. Another page on the spreadsheet does all of the various SPL sensitivities and voltage sensitivities and powers of the speakers, and it just works its way through and tells me how many watts I need for the amplifiers. And that's the sort of calculation it does. If you happen to have something that's 100 dB, 2.8 volts into 4 ohms, then for convenience to align with the, you know, 8303 thing, it'll be 103 dB for 4 volts. If you want to keep that 10 meters away, then you need 10 times the voltage drive into it, that is 40 volts. 40 volts over 4 ohms is 400 watts. So you need at least a 400 watt amplifier to drive the thing. You know, and in fact, if you had a 501 or a 601, that's all to the good. So, you know, we're talking serious powers for commercial cinema. And I guess if you want to have peaks into a home hi-fi, you probably still need 200 or 300 watts in a home hi-fi to avoid any sort of possibility of clipping. I mean, the speakers might distort a little bit, but that's probably better than the amplifier clipping. And domestic frequency responses, we usually aim for flat, and I'm continually astounded when I look in the English Hi-Fi News magazine, Hi-Fi News and Record Review used to be, and they have these super duper exotic speakers, and they've got like 6 and 7 and 8 and 10 dB variations in the sound pressure level. And I sort of think, you want me to pay 20,000 quid for a pair of those? So it's astounding what gets passed off as bright sound or active sound or vibrant sound when it's by no means flat at all. The other assumption that's sort of built into hi-fi speakers being flat is that, as you probably know, speakers get directive as the frequency goes up. So if your woofer gets directive and then you cross over to a mid-range and then that gets directive and you cross over to a tweeter and then that gets directive, that the flat response for near-field listening has built into it the fact that most, you know, small hi-fi type loudspeakers are getting more and more directive, so there's less energy, less power going into the room in the higher frequencies. So somewhere, and one of the dilemmas I've got, because I'm rejigging some of our smaller cinema stuff for people with large home cinemas, is do I make it flat frequency response, but then I've also got flat directivity response? Is there then going to be too much high frequency energy? Should I just back it off a couple of dB to allow for the fact that home hi-fi, what people are used to listening to is home hi-fis, and what I'm presenting them with is a solid wall of whack high frequency sound right out to the limits? And so at the moment I've got two or three systems out on sort of beta test, if you like, with various sorts of various amounts of high frequency roll off, not as much as this SMPTE curve that you can see, but still, you know, a couple of dB down at 10 kilohertz, dead flat to 10 kilohertz. Interesting question. So I guess I'll wait and see what the users think about just how much for so much. Because, you know, without blowing my own trumpet too much, I have design horns that have a very good uniform directivity response out to, you know, 10 or 15 kilohertz. So I can choose whatever level of high frequency energy I want to put into the room by, you know, tailoring the amount of high frequency flatness or roll off, as the case may be. And domestic, usually we're talking about plus or minus 10 degrees vertically, plus or minus 30 degrees horizontally, which is fine if you're sitting in a predictable position in a lounge chair and the room's fairly small and there's a limited amount of geometry. Commercial situations where you want to cover this sort of an audience, you probably need at least 20, 30 degrees, at least 60 degrees that way. So where you've got to cover the reasonable size of audience, then different considerations apply, and you're trying to look at some sort of horn loading or constant directivity loading or some sort of line array gizmo. Either way, simple drivers don't sort of cut the mustard anymore. And if we just think about technical stuff for a minute, you all remember Teeley small parameters, don't you? Wow. It's just a way of characterising a moving coil loudspeaker in terms of resonance, apparent stiffness, mechanical cue, electrical cue, so on and so forth. You can buy various little bits of software that you measure the resonant curve of the speaker, put a lump of plasticine or something on, remeasure it again, and it spits out all these sorts of numbers telling you what the apparent mass of the cone is, the acoustical compliance or the mechanical compliance, depending on what units you want to design your enclosure in, so on and so forth. So that's, you know, fairly easy to do once you get all that. And my colleague uses Leap 5, which is a jazzy Windows-based thing. I still use Leap 4, 3, 2, 1, which is DOS-based. So the graphs don't look nearly as pretty as this. One of the things I thought was instructive for you, a lot of people use the Cheerly small stuff and design the thing small signal wise, what happens if you put 100 watts into the system? You know, normally you design it on a 1 watt level. You put 100 watts in, you can see in fact the voice coils heated up, which I'll show you in the next slide. The cues changed, and there's a bit of a peak now in the low frequency response. Now, some people design what they call, it's a sagging sort of an alignment. So the box is a bit bigger and the tuning's a bit lower than the speaker, but as it heats up and the cue changes, the thing comes back to be flat at higher powers. So that's a possibility for Tierly small things as well. I don't think anybody really designs ideal maximally flat fourth order Butterworths anymore, if only because the room that you put it in has got some sort of room gain at low frequencies. So you really need to have some sort of sagging response to allow for the fact that the room gain, on average, whatever that is boosting the bass a bit, and so you can end up with reasonably uniform perceived bass level. So in some ways, designing speakers is a bit like tuning musical instruments. You can get a certain bits and pieces and put them together, and then you've still got the choice of how much bass, how much treble relative to the mid-range. You've got some sort of, not quite fashion choices, but artistic type choices to make as to just how much bass do you want for this particular speaker for the sort of applications it's likely to be used in, whether it's domestic rooms or larger rooms or so on and so forth. So that's interesting that things happen at higher powers. If you look at the impedance curve, you can see how the curve that originally we started out with two symmetrical peaks, which is what you're supposed to do when you're tuning the bass reflex enclosure and so on and so forth. Whack a bit of power into it, voice coil heats up, Q changes. In this case, I think the vent's chuffing a bit at low frequency, so you're getting losses through the vent as well, more losses through the cabinet. The whole complexion changes. Well, we saw that in the frequency response, didn't we? The frequency response. Drawing it for you moved up a bit and got a bit more peaky. So you can see what's happening in the electrical response as well, in the impedance response. And the cone excursion, typical vented box, cone excursion rises as the frequency goes down, the vented box tuning lowers it all and the vent does all the work at that frequency, and then the whole thing goes to hell in a handbasket and you're back down to having just the thing in open air effectively because there's no loading from the box. That's fine. Whack a bit of stick into it and you're getting all sorts of funnies happening, including over-excursion in the loudspeaker. So simulation is all very well, but in this case the mechanical limits of the loudspeaker are about 5 or 6 millimetres, so there's no way it's going to be making over 10 millimetres at those frequencies. One of the advantages of designing for cinema is that you can then specify in the digital crossover box, thank you, I'll have a little high-pass filter at the right sort of cut-off frequency so I can just, a bit hard to show, roll the excursion off here by the high-pass filter so that these two things are about equal peaks. So that way you can get more power out of the system as a whole without risk of overdriving it and stuff. You don't have to then over-dimension and over-specify the whole thing just in case somebody puts too much power into it. You can arrange things as part of the system design. And distortion is another somewhat vexed question. It's amazing how much distortion you can't hear, actually. I've got a couple of examples here. 4-inch titanium compression driver. It's making 120 dB at 1 metre, so we sort of have to have our earplugs on in the whole factory, not just where we're doing the testing. So that's equivalent to 100 dB at 10 metres. So we're making some seriously loud amounts of sound. And the sort of thing you get is that sort of distortion where there's a few percent second harmonic and the third harmonic is quite low. And one argument for using more than a two-way system is that as the distortion creeps up at high frequencies, you can cross over to another compression driver where it's lower. And similarly, as the distortion creeps up at low frequencies, you can cross over to a mid-range horn. So a three-way system or a four-way system is good for picking drivers working in the best of their piston ranges and the best of their distortion ranges as well. And a single 15-inch driver has got about that sort of distortion curve. Some of the sharp humps and bumps are caused by the tin shed rattling, and others are caused by standing waves coming off the environment and stuff, because although we're measuring at 1 metre, sound still does come back and you know, at the wrong time, if you like, and affect the value, value of the sine wave that you're measuring. So you've got to sort of put a pretty broad brush, straight line through the middle of the humps and bumps and say, yes, it's about that much distortion. But by and large, second harmonic is reasonably innocuous. I mean, you hear it as a slight fullness of tone. Well, it's all valve amplifier sound, isn't it? A bit of fullness of tone and richness and all that sort of stuff. And it's the third harmonic that we tend to worry about when we're looking, assessing loudspeakers or doing designs or thinking about the power ratings of things. And I guess over the 10, 15 years or so I've been at Crixus, I've designed a range of horns, got a range of boxes, and so we can mix and match them in a whole range of different two-way and three-way and four-way cinema systems. The biggest system, four-way system on there, I think can make about 30 or 40 acoustic watts, which depending on which book you read is the same as a symphony orchestra. And there's three of those behind the screen, thank you very much. Mind you, it's a pretty big cinema as well. But and it wouldn't sound like a symphony orchestra because it's coming from too concentrated a point in the auditorium or the venue. But yeah, it's a useful exercise sometimes to calculate the acoustic power output that these things can do based on the on-axis sensitivity and the beam angle of a particular frequency. I guess what you should do when you're designing a loudspeaker is look for the off-axis performance, and by that I mean, I was waving my hands around before saying how the woofers get beamy, and then if you cross over straight to a tweeter in a two-way system, there's too big a change in the off-axis response, both horizontally and vertically, and so the off-axis sound into the room is coloured, is affecting the reverberation, and you hear a two-way speaker differently to what you would hear a three-way speaker, even if it had the same, exactly the same bits and pieces and exactly the same frequency response. Because the three-way speaker, the woofer would get beamy, over to the mid-range, get a bit beamy, and so you'd have a better behaved off-axis response, is what I'm getting around to saying. So it's fairly rare, I think, that people start from the directivity performance of each of the drivers they're going to use in their system, and then look to see whether they're going to work frequency response-wise. Most people, I suspect, do it the other way around, and they should really consider both. You've probably heard of a guy called Floyd Toole, who used to work for Harman International, and before that was with the National Research Council in Canada. He's written this great big thick book, Sound Reproduction, it's called Loudspeakers and Rooms, and that would have to be, it's just the distillation of 30 years' work, and that would have to be one of the books to get for loud, you know, if you're a loudspeaker designer, or even if you're not. Because he delves into the whole business of this sort of stuff, into listening tests, into perception, room acoustics, you name it. He's poked around in it and done some pretty good systematic research work and come up with conclusions that he can prove work. So, enough of directivity and stuff. It helps, I guess, if the loudspeakers are more or less the same sensitivity, because if you're designing a passive crossover, then you don't have too much juggling to do to get them to match up. Otherwise, you end up with massive humps and bumps in the frequency response. And I guess from a production point of view, it's helpful if whoever makes your drivers can keep the sensitivity of the drivers within a dB or so as well. Otherwise you get a poor sensitivity low frequency driver and a high sensitivity mid-range and maybe a low sensitivity, and you end up with broad plateaus and shelves in your multi-way loudspeakers caused by driver sensitivity tolerance. But then that's what we have QC suites and measurements and things for. And that's one I did the other day, which is an active crossover for a three-way system. That's a gated Melissa measurement up on our tower, which is 2.5 metres high or something. And it came up fairly well, really. It's 10th octave smoothing, I think, as well. Yeah. So you won't see too many manufacturers who give you fairly high resolution plots like that. The humps and bumps down the bottom end are because there was still one floor reflection that if I close that up, time gate that up, then you get a very funny looking low frequency performance, measured low frequency performance. It's not actually, because of the very short time window you're using, you don't get the right representation of low frequencies, I guess. And depending on where you put the microphone and where you can, how much gating you use, that's the same loudspeaker, same condition, shorter gating time. So you can see there's less apparent low frequency response for some, a very good reason, shorter gating time. And what I did was move the microphone across the front of the loudspeaker away a little bit. The loudspeaker was lying on its side, and I was originally lined up with the join axis of the box and the mid-range speaker, and then I moved it across the mid-range speaker and then moved it to the join axis of the mid-range horn and the high-frequency speaker. And you can see subtle little variations, subtle little variations in the mid-range level, depending exactly how which bits on and off axis you are, because the sources are a bit too far apart and you're getting lobes forming at those crossover frequencies. And that's the sort of thing of a stack of three horns meant for a four-way system. And again, that's a passive crossover network. Time-gated, but the time-gating can be quite short because there's no low-frequency response to speak of from a mid-range horn. And that's more or less how things combine together. And then this is an interesting graph. This is the beam angle measured both horizontally and vertically. Horizontally, you're getting a fairly good 90 degree dispersion out of the system because it's just a vertical stack. Vertical beam angle, every time you come across two loudspeakers radiating the same frequency but spaced some wavelengths apart, you're going to get lobes, off-axis lobes and things formed, which look like that. So the reason that the beam angle is artificially narrow on this graph at the crossover frequencies is because there's a lobe out there and then there's energy going out at sort of wider angles than you perhaps you'd expect. There's still a reasonable same sort of energy going into the room, it's just distributed a bit differently. And that happens with all loudspeakers if they're arranged on vertical array. End of story, no arguments. I mean, if you're crossing over from some sort of bass speaker to a little dome tweeter, couple of kilohertz or more, you're already a wavelength and a half apart, and you just can't get the dome tweeter close enough if you're using a separate dome tweeter. I guess if you glue it on the front of a magnet like Kef do, then you'll make a coaxial system like Tanawa do, you can be a bit better off from that point of view. But then, whatever that speaker is, you've still got the same problem crossing over to the next one down, be it a bass speaker or a subwoofer or whatever. So it's fairly hard to do. And then that's the actual directivity index, which is all of the sound pressure levels summed compared to the on-axis, the design axis one. And by and large, that stack of horns is reasonably consistent as far as the actual power into the room is concerned. That's what directivity index is all about. Now, that's a whole lot more difficult to do when you're using direct radiators, mid-ranges and direct radiator tweeters. Usually the directivity index has got some quite interesting ripples and humps and bumps in it, caused by the energy into the room changing as you go up through the frequency range. And again, Mr. Tool says speakers that rate well in listening tests, and you've got a scale of 10 and he's talking about 7.5, 7.6, 7.7, those sorts of ratings, which is about the best he seems to be able to get, they've got very well controlled off-axis responses as well as on-axis response. And that's the sort of measuring environment I'm talking about. I'm not sure whether you can see. You maybe have to turn the lights out a bit. But that's a Dexian tower, 2.5 metres in the air. Nobody's fallen off it yet, but we're working on that. And the speaker's up there on an aluminium beam so that I can lie a whole speaker on its side. There's a little round thing underneath, which is the computer-controlled turntable for doing the plus and minus 90-degree measurements and stuff. Except that the turntable's sort of showing its age a bit. When I put one of the four-way systems on, which is like 300 or 400 kilograms and another 100 kilograms of counterweight to counterweight the bass speaker, for some reason it doesn't want to turn. I can't think why. It's got a tiny little stepper motor thing in it. But it's great fun measuring all these things and then pondering over the results. If you want to design just a simple two-way system, the sort of thing you see with PA boxes and stuff, 15-inch driver, some sort of horn, then the sort of thing you've got to cope with is firstly the low-frequency driver. Again, this is gated fairly drastically to try and get some sort of accurate representation of what's going on in that particular frequency range. The woofer's got a fairly large cone resonance peak and dies, and of course the high-frequency unit is 10 dB more or more sensitivity above it. So what you've got to do is get onto your trusty computer simulator program like Leap, you import the frequency response, the phase response, and the electrical impedance of both drivers, and then start playing around with inductors and capacitors to see what you can do to roll off the woofer sufficiently good. This peak, that peak doesn't upset the roll off too much, and at the same time not getting the impedance going down a half an ohm or something like that, which is quite easy to do with, you know, large inductors and, you know, high quality capacitors and stuff. And a useful thing I find using, again, it's the older version of Leap, but I guess it's the same in the new version, is to start off with, okay, let me do a, you know, second order Butterworth, third order Butterworth, 900 hertz at 8 ohms, see what that looks like acoustically and the electrical impedance wise, and then, okay, let's do a third order Butterworth at 7 ohms or 6 ohms, or try a second order one because you've got an acoustic roll off built into the actual loudspeaker acoustic response as well. So the idea is to try and get a reasonably well behaved acoustic roll off without the electrical impedance going bananas and getting too low. And once you've done that, then you can do the same sort of technique with the high-frequency horn. But in this case, if you just design a normal sort of third-order or fourth-order Butterworth high-pass crossover, of course, it's useless because my sensitivity is too high. So what I then do is say, OK, let's make a 10-ohm, you know, use the values for a 10-ohm crossover or a 20-ohm crossover or a 30-ohm crossover. And so you end up with a crossover with a deliberately very large sagging response. And that sagging response is complementary to that slope there. And so you can end up with the two things matching fairly well. And it's got nothing to do with design formula or anything like that. It's to do with just trying to make it work. And that's the two impulse. The other thing you've got to deal with, of course, is that the things aren't exactly at the same distance from the microphone. So you can see a little dotty line, which is the impulse response of the low frequency thing, fairly slow, and then of course a big sharp spike, because that's the frequency response of the more sensitive horn system. It's larger for two reasons. Firstly, because Melissa is a white noise system, so there's more energy at the high frequency end. And secondly, because the high frequency driver is heaps more sensitive than the low frequency driver. So there's also the time alignment problem you've got to worry about. And you can often, that's looking at the phase response of the two systems. And, you know, with a bit of Pangossian looks, you can say, oh yeah, I think that frequency is round about where they're going to be acoustically in phase. Let's start rolling them off there and see if we can get a crossover happening there. Quite often you find that you end up exactly 180 degrees out of phase, so you just change the phase of the high frequency unit, and then all sine wave wise, it all blends up. Impulse wise or step response wise, it's not going to be too flash because the two are time aligned differently anyway. This is for passive crossovers. Active crossovers, of course, you can just dial up the right number of microseconds delay and away you go. It's fairly easy by comparison. But you then need an extra box of electronics, of course. And the net result looks something like that, where, because I hate resistors in crossovers, because I think they're a waste of energy, I've actually left a bit more high frequency energy in that system than I normally would. It goes behind a great big thick perforated plastic screen which rolls off all that high frequency energy anyway, and more. And so cinema loudspeakers are always equalised in situ. So in this particular case, this is a perfectly acceptable little two-wave cinema system. People chuck it up behind the screen, do a bit of pink noise equalisation, and away it goes. And I've since re-engineered this particular system to make it more suitable for smaller direct radiator home. Near field listening almost, you know, rooms this size. And so I've had to put a bit of a resistive attenuator in there to get it to be flat and so on and so forth. But something that people don't think about much with loudspeaker designers, although they should, perhaps, is how much power each of these individual bits and pieces is going to have. That's almost the same answer as how long is a bit of string, because it depends whether you're looking at the average power in speech and music, as in the long-term average, or the IEC have produced a revised curve with a bit more high-frequency energy to allow for rock and roll and compressed sound and techno and disco and all that sort of stuff. Or you can look at just the average power in speech and music as comes from movie cinemas and stuff, and voices and dialogue and stuff. So mostly, most of the energy is in the 300, 400, 500 hertz region, and that's where you need the most power handling and the most oomph, if you like, and the lowest distortion as well. And interesting little table of values there. I found a couple of AS papers from way back. If you want something to survive peak noise and you've got the crossover to 1,000 hertz, then you really need a 60-40 dissipation, 60 watts into the woofer, 40 watts into the tweeter, which would melt most of them. If, however, you're looking at music noise type input, which is the IEC type stuff, then you can really get away with an 80-20 split. 80% of the power's in the woofer, up to 1 kilohertz. 20% of the long-term power is in the tweeter. And that's a bit more livable with, you know, it's fortunate that you need small speakers to reproduce high frequencies. It's also fortunate there's not much energy, long-term energy in high frequencies, because otherwise you'd sort of burn up a bit. And three-way system, again, the same sort of thing. Peak noise of 100 watts gives you the 30, 20, 36, because there's a fair bit of energy even crossing over at 1600 hertz. Music noise stuff, it's better. It's, 60, 30, 10, you know. So if you want your device to survive long term, then you should make sure that the thermal dissipation of the three units you're using is at least this sort of stuff. You know, if it's a 100 watt system, not notional. And four-way system, which have got crossovers at 300, 1600 and 5 kilohertz, the UHF bit above 5 kilohertz is getting fairly negligible powers, but you have somebody to do cymbal clashes or you've got some special effect or something. It still needs to be able to cope with the peak powers, just for an instant, but not necessarily the long-term stuff. So, and that took, you know, a few weeks worth of research to figure out where all this information was and then to do some calculations and try and work all that sort of stuff out. It does change slightly. The steeper the crossovers, the more defined, if you like, the boundaries are. First of all, crossovers, you get so much energy in the woofer and so much energy back the other way in the tweeter. I don't know that I want to really use first order crossovers in any sort of commercial or high-powered application, because the high-frequency unit just wouldn't cope. It would just be, you know, double wall off, steep enough. So, summary. Really, the choice of the crossover frequencies is a real compromise between all the factors I've just talked about. Hopefully, you can find the right sort of drivers at the right sort of price. Another important consideration, of course, and fit them all together and make a reasonable sort of system out of them. And one that lasts a reasonable amount of time, so because you've got the right sort of power handling in each of the devices that make up the system. And something you probably ought to do when you're designing a loudspeaker is actually listen to it. Shock horror. It helps if you've got double-blind listening tests set up and things like that. But even so, if you've got the same set of music that you use and you've heard it on different speakers in different rooms, you can play, like I've got my Rebecca Pigeon Spanish Harlem track and a few other bits and pieces, you can get a pretty fair idea of what the speaker's like, you know, whether it's just a little bit too much like this or a little bit too much like that. And we're talking fairly sort of subtle differences that it's pretty hard to pick up in measurement. As well as you play a bit of booming tis, and it's got the one man of booming tis to make it sound like a reasonably live type of loudspeaker. So you really need to do some listening tests. And I guess on the basis of that, you might go back and tweak the crossover a little bit and tweak the level of something somewhere or another just to make it sound a little bit more acceptable on particular genres of music as compared to other genres of music. I think Sean Olive, who's the incoming president, by the way, not me, sorry, looked at all Freud Tools listening tests and did a correlation between the bandwidth and the smoothness and the low frequency cutoff, and found that the 10 dB down point gave you the best correlation with quality. Still only a 50% correlation, but the lower the 10 dB frequency was, the better the speaker sounded. So bandwidth comes into it. The smoothness comes into it, and all the off-axis stuff comes into it, and I guess reasonably low distortion is a given for the sort of speakers we're talking about. Floyd Tool has done a huge body of work specifying all the ways you've got to measure and test and look at, and I think I think it's either JBL or Harman have got this circulator thing that measures the whole front hemisphere of the speaker. And then in accordance with his research work, he puts together the plus and minus 10, plus and minus 30 axis and says, righto, that's the main sound that the listener will perceive. And then there's angles down here and angles up there, which are the floor mounts and the ceiling mounts, add in certain proportions as well. And he can more or less predict what the in-room response is going to be, knowing that the room, the geometry of the room and stuff. And also, I guess, the apparent low-frequency and high-frequency extensions, and predict how it will perform in the rating tests without actually having to go through the fairly expensive and time-consuming business of doing double-blind tests with lots of different listeners and forms and multiple choice things and all that sort of business. So loudspeaker design is getting to be a lot more of a science than it used to be, but it's still some ways to go. I'm glad to turn it because it keeps me in business. And I guess once you've done your listening tests, you've really then got to do a final set of measurements for QC purposes and or marketing spec purposes and so on and so forth. Final check on your power dissipations in case you've just accidentally shifted crossover frequencies and so on and so forth. And I guess a final listening test on a pair that have been put together by the factory rather than put together by you, just to make sure they haven't left bits of fluff hanging on the backs of woofer cones and stuff like that, like extraneous rattles and buzzes. And just as a digression, in recent times at Crix's, I managed to design and build a listening test chamber, which I think is 3.6 metres square and 4.something metres high, double wall thickness, to keep the factory noise out so we can do QC measurements on loudspeakers. And it's quite interesting that we found rattles and buzzes come from the tweeter plates not being properly screwed down. Sometimes the screws underneath woofers, you know, that encounters a bit of gunk in the MDF and doesn't screw down properly, so the screw is loose and so that rattles and buzzes. So we now try and, or the vent hasn't been glued in properly. All sorts of things happen in production circumstances, which now we've got a very good method, a reasonably quiet environment, because you wheel these things in on a trolley like a mini crematorium sort of thing, and do all these rattle and buzz tests and things, and then if it passes, fine, back in my box and sell it. And I guess future directions are lower distortion, cheaper drivers, but still with the same performance, or better. And I guess trying to improve these beaminess, these polar lobing and stuff that happens in the vertical axis by making the speakers concentrics. And I've just finished working on finalising a patent of a way of combining mid-frequency speakers on the sides of a horn together with a two-way compression driver to make three horns in the same horn shape, if you like, so that a lot of the off-axis stuff is minimised, eliminated, etc., etc. So, that's about it. Conclusions. So I think I said, still a work in progress, fortunately. It's me in business anyway. And if you really want to know about loudspeakers, go and buy Floyd Tools' book. It's a Focal Press thing. And study it. It will take you a couple of years worth of study to accommodate all the stuff that's in there and sort of thoroughly digest it and internalise it. Yeah. Thank you for your attention. Any questions? Yes, Graham.
There were a couple. The first one was the SPL with distance. Is any attempt made to get the drawback to the flatter these days, or is it you just let it be the inverse square law?
Just inverse square law. That is a more stringent test than trying to do some sort of full, highly complicated acoustic calculation allowing for average reverbs of chairs and thingies.
Think about the measurement when you actually measure. Do you do a drawback curve on those? So you pull the microphone back and see what the variation is.
Oh, no, I don't care whether it's inverse square. I just put it two-thirds the distance and say, it's got to make it. Yeah.
And are we going to introduce distortion measurements at some level into the 70 AES standards? Because I'm prepared to talk on it.
Well, that will be rather interesting to see which representatives on the committee think that's a good idea and which don't want to know because their speakers aren't good enough. Well, it's certainly a major, having a perforated, thick tent type screen with a few holes in front of your loudspeakers is a major drawback to having good sound. Fortunately, they can now do woven screens, which, you know, the weaving room, if you like, is getting bigger and bigger and getting up to commercial cinema screen size sizes. And that's essentially the same as the sort of hi-fi cloth that you see across speakers anyway. And I really hope they do that. But then the trouble is, because it's a woven screen, it's got some sort of grain, and so then you've got the Moiré patterns of the pixels of the projector, all too hard, you know. But perforated screens, I think, are about the single worst thing that's in a cinema. And when we're talking, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 dB loss at 10 kHz and even more higher up, and it's got to the point, I think, that even if we wanted to get more high frequency level in cinemas, I'm not sure the compression drivers are up to it, because you're cutting away half of them trying to get them to fire through this blasted screen. So the SIPD curve is a bit of an engineering compromise. Admittedly, it's come from 40 odd years ago, but it also sort of, you know, makes it a bit easier to make the speakers make the sound.
Well, in the absence of a distortion measurement, we just do failure as the driver failure as the limit. So
do. Yeah.
Interesting
tests. Oh, well, they are, yes. I mean, we've had, one of the local cinemas had a bit of a problem. Oh, actually, it was a cinema in South Korea that I went to that the projectionist came to me and said, I don't think there's enough bass here, you know. So I stuck a bit of pink noise from the Dolby processor through it, and sure enough, there wasn't. So I wound up the wick a bit and I could hear flap, 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 and poof. So I said, we've got four woofers there, four single woofers. How about you go down there and see they're all wired and say, sure enough, one of them was reverse polarity. Mm-hmm. So in effect, they were cancelling each other out, and then there was only two subwoofers trying to do the job of four. You know, to make the 113 dB two-thirds of the way back or something. So I'm glad I fixed that for them. But yeah, that's something. And we've had other subwoofers that have, drivers that have come back to us with nothing around the surround, and it turns out they've been accidentally connected antiphase and been trying to work too hard for a while, cancelling each other out. So yes, it does happen. People abuse speakers, mainly because I suppose they should really check all the basics first, you know.
If the screen is a problem, why can't you move the speaker out from behind the screen and have the two left and right speakers?
Well, because cinemas for donkey's use have had a centre channel for the dialogue.
I understand that, but why can't you put the centre channel above the screen or below the screen?
Yes, but then you've got the path length difference. You know, it's a phantom image and not a real image. And the NHK people with their ultra high definition cinema, in fact, have a solid screen and like 8,000 lines or something. It's unbelievable. And they put phantom channel, cinema channel above and below. It still doesn't really work as well as having, you know, one where the face is on the screen, where the dialogue is coming from. Yeah, I know.
And also the fact that in a cinema you get these crazy shooting positions, so.
Oh, yeah, to get the most revenue, they come right down to the.
Yeah, you just can't do that.
And so what you do then is hear the bottom centre channel a bit far too loud, and all the voices will be coming from here, and you'd be looking up there. So there'd be a bit, you know, it would make the illusion of a cinema a bit harder to sustain, I guess.
So how does that account for the low level of centre channel dialogue? It seems to be a problem. I don't know, is it post-production work, or is it the speakers in the cinema?
I don't know.
You really are struggling sometimes to hear the centre channel.
Yeah, well, that's
often. I was in the cinema yesterday. Because it's okay.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's
when the actors are talking, it just seems to be buried. I don't know. Is it me? I'm going deaf, or?
Well, it could be they've had a fault for donkey's years. You know, the high frequency horn on the centre channel isn't working anymore, and nobody's actually noticed. And nobody's complained enough.
Well, the actors don't project their voice enough, isn't it?
Oh, by and large, they. I think most movies will have reasonable voice quality in the centre channel, and if it's not there, then there's quite likely to be a fault in the centre channel. I mean, things go for almost years in some cinemas before anybody notices that half the surrounds don't work, for example, or that one of the subwoofers isn't working, but there's still enough oomph out of the other one that's there.
So in every cinema, how many centre channel speakers do you put in? Three-way?
Oh, no, that's still, most of them would be two-way, which is just a... either a double 15 or not some sort of horn above it. Now, if the horn blows, the crossover's at 500 hertz or something for the old-fashioned stuff, And so if the high frequency horn blows or something, then you're listening to some pretty muffled sort of room voice quality stuff.
But what height is that speaker at?
It'd be 2/3 of the screen height.
Is it?
So it's up a fair way in the air. Mm.
Behind the screen?
Yes. Mm. Oh yes, it gets quite adventurous trying to change compression drivers when you've got a screen here that you can't fall through because you'll stretch it and then people will see the sag in it, and a wall full of fiberglass on the other side that you don't want to touch because you're going to get itchy in the front. And you're like up 10 metres up in the air, you know, as well. So, yeah, sorry, John.
Yeah, your opening remark about a proxy guard,
mm.
I must have been really going to this. It was an excursion in there to the local multiplex because they had just reinstalled a whole set of digital stuff.
Mm.
And it meant to be obvious from just the trailers and the ads beforehand. Totally boxy, bouncing off the back wall.
Mm.
I said, how can this be state of the art sound in a new scenario?
Yeah.
You did, to what extent, for instance, is the distance between the centre channel speaker and the front of the screen comprise a reflection of
anything from a couple,
which will actually put a boxy peak, so I would think, somewhere in that.
Well, there's a couple of problems with the screen that's in front of the horn systems. If the speaker's just pointing straight out, and 20 or 30% of the energy hits the screen, goes straight back in there, and you can actually see the changes in electrical impedance and stuff caused by the reflections from the thing. So it certainly doesn't do the response much good. I mean, that's why they do third octave measurements in cinemas, because anything else is too many humps and bumps and it will frighten you. And often if you then angle it down, the horns down a little bit, then at least the sound is bouncing back off onto something else. And hopefully there's enough. I mean, the ideal situation is to have an infinite baffle wall covered with about this much fiberglass, so that if you are angling these in, into the fiberglass, you see, and this one, into the...
I suppose if you put the screen too close...
Oh, it's about this far away.
It must be vibrated by the, especially the low frequency.
A little bit, but not that much.
A little bit the image.
Well, the vibration's towards you, so you don't see it.
No, it's just optically averaged out.
So what's the distance generally from the back wall of the cinema, the loudspeaker, then the screen? What are we looking at?
Well, in the good old days, it was more than a metre, because large format horns were 800 deep, plus the compression driver, plus a bit of tilt on it. These days, you're lucky if it's more than about 600 or 700 millimetres.
Really?
And one of the advantages of a three-way system is that the horns are shorter, and you can make it in the same depth as the box, which is about 450 or 500 deep. And then plus a bit here, plus a bit there, that's it. So
that
there's...
Something
yeah.
Mm. There's no acoustic space there for it.
Oh, it would be better to be closer to the wall, and you know, because then the real wall reflection bit is at a higher frequency a bit. And with a bit of cunning, you can make that reflect that distance such that the reflection is outside the range of the speaker, it's crossed over to the mid-range. So the bass speaker doesn't, which emits omnidirectionally, doesn't emit any of the frequencies that are going to bounce off and come back and upset its frequency response. You know, that's more by good luck than good judgment, I think.
So in the design stage, you were talking earlier about the room sizes and those sorts of things. Are there any specifications for reverberation characteristics of
the... Yeah. There's... I think Dolby have put one out, THX have put one out, in general books on architect. Not sure about the IEC, I don't think they want to be involved, but it's upwards a quarter of a second, half a second maybe at the most. Certainly you don't need, and then it bows to the laws of physics and sort of can get hugely bigger down at low frequencies and stuff. But yes, it should be reasonably uniform and quite well controlled, and for... What's the word? The side reflections and the floor and ceiling reflections and all that sort of business. I think in Adelaide, the South Australian Film Court recently had a couple of cinemas made from scratch and designed acoustically. My God, you look at the stuff that's in them and you think, that all the walls are slightly angled and all the panels are different panels and different sound absorbers different frequencies of sound absorbers in different positions to counteract the lateral spread in the thingy and the what's going on. So yeah, to get it, it sounds good, yeah. But yes, doing the a proper acoustical job on cinemas just often isn't done for, you know, cost reasons. Sorry.
One supplementary, but in the context of the crossovers that you're talking about, wouldn't it be much more simple to use purely electronic crossovers rather than trying to go passive?
Yeah, it's extra money. It's extra wires. I mean, I once had to design a passive crossover for a three-way system to incorporate the box as well as the horns, because we'd sold this to some little local independent cinema, and he said, have you got two wires going down to the... Yeah, you've got two wires. And they meant two wires. They didn't mean two pairs of wires. They meant so there was no chance of running a second pair of wires down there to do the active field back up on the bio box. So I had to devise this huge crossover with a coil like this and a bank of capacitors to roll the main box off and roll the horns on and just bolt it to the side of the box and wire it all up then and there, sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, if you build the cinema with active crossovers in mind, then you run all the wires down in the first place and away you go. You know, the same way it's prudent as well to run a wire to each of the surround speakers rather than parallel them all up, because if one fails and you don't know quite which one it is, then you can at least separate all the wires and say, oh, number one, number two, number three, number four's gone. Otherwise, you've got to get a ladder and go up and try and listen, and it gets quite expensive. And cinemas don't have that much downtime that you can do this sort of stuff in, usually. I mean, they try and make them work all the time. Sorry, you had a question.
I was more of a comment. Showing my age somewhat, when Firefox first came out, Dolby Labs came out to Melbourne and the Hoyt Cinemas here and put on a demonstration of just how fantastic Dolby was.
Mm.
With that experience in mind, very shortly after, I went up to see the Steaming Cinema in Darwin was working there at the time. And I came out blaming the cinema for such horrendous sound. It was really, really terrible. I blamed the cinema for years until I eventually bought a DVD of the Sting, because I still love the music. And the soundtrack on the DVD was exactly the same as the one I heard in the cinema. There's nothing wrong with the cinema, it was on the soundtrack of the movie.
Yes, that's right. So yes, there are bad soundtracks.
But post-production.
So what is the fate of the famed or ill-famed Academy curve?
Oh, well, hopefully we're going to junk it.
but it's still a part of the chain, the B chain, that when you do the monitoring in the sound stages,
yes, it's supposed to be set to that.
And that's what the mix is judged against, passed through that, which is based on a measurement of a couple of hundred cinema houses in America in the mid-30s.
Oh, no, it's been upgraded since then. SMPTE 202M, or the ISO 2969 curve, was based on some experiments that were done. I'm trying to think of the guy's name. Robert Schulein, I think, did one set of experiments of having the same pair of speakers. In this case, I think they were JBLs, close up and far away, and give people a mixing desk, make the far field ones sound the same as the near field ones, and most people ended up rolling off the high frequency energy a bit. And you look at the raw results in his AES paper, it's all over the place, but by and large, you started a couple of kilohertz and rolled it off a bit, and that was a useful, help get all the equipment working properly without burning out compression drivers like mad. This is back in the days of two-way systems, when there was a large, you know, 4-inch titanium diaphragm and a great big horn with a mouth 800 square and 800 deep, 500 hertz crossover, all that sort of stuff. So, in a way, it was a marriage of convenience, and real-time analyzers had just come in, so you could actually put some microphones around and see and twiddle and do things and stuff.
It was particularly, I think, a product of the mono-optical track.
That was an earlier iteration of the system.
Yeah.
That they were rolling stuff off to avoid all the, like 78 records have got a lot of high-frequency noise in them. They were doing that, but once they got rid of that and got into reasonable sorts of soundtracks, and certainly once Dolby SR came along and Dolby Digital and stuff, but they're still sticking with the fact that in the mixdown studio, drawing it for you, you roll the high frequencies off in a particular way, and you then do your mix to make the treble sound right and everything, and then when you play it back in the same system, in a system on the other side of the world, but with the same sort of roll-off, it's supposed to sound the same. And I guess one of the AES things I went to, some quite influential people from the LA scene were saying, well, we try and do this, and we do all our lovely, real-time, and they sound different, why are they sounding different? And the answer is that they're not really measuring what they think they're measuring with real-time pink noise in a real-time analyzer type situation. And they really want to have some sort of more direct sound measurement type stuff. I mean, I've got fairly good results by just finding the nearest step ladder and putting the microphone up. Well, be where Graham's sitting, putting it up on a ladder, right up in the middle of the cinema, and then just still using pink noise, but at least I'm so far away from the boundaries that I'm getting a bit more accurate representation of pink noise of the actual response of the speakers. I've tried measuring using Melissa as well, but the screen reflections are just so bad that you sort of look at the high frequency like this and you think, well, I suppose there's an average through there somewhere. Maybe I'll just, the screen is really a major, is what I see as a major problem for trying to get reasonable sound in the cinema. You can fudge it a bit, but ultimately you're going to have to get rid of that blasted screen. It does rather destroy the point of going to the pictures, I think.
Are your speakers active or passive?
Mostly they're active. I mean, I've designed a range of passive crossovers as well as the numbers for a range of active crossovers so that our customers can have what they want. I mean, some people go, mostly for three-way systems, they would bi-amp it and have a passive crossover for the two horns and an active crossover for the bass bin to the thingy. But some people go the whole hog and have a fully active four-way system, which means there's four amplifiers for each screen channel, 12 amplifiers, thank you very much. Never mind what you need for subs and what you need for surrounds and, back surrounds and so on and so forth.
Getting rid of the screen brings to mind something that seems to...
Baby with bathwater.
...occur about every decade, and it comes out of turn that there's marvellous new development with thin speakers that actually look like a picture or a painting.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Now, perhaps we can take that to extremists and say, can you not make the screen the membrane of a large electrostatic loudspeaker?
Well, the trouble is you need a perforated plate in front of it to attract it backwards and forwards, so that does...
Yeah, you use the current rather than the voltage analysis.
But I mean, the NXT people were trying to do that with their, generic radio, travelling wave type, radiator type stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think they made some fairly large panels with fairly powerful drivers on, but I suspect the efficiency is such that you're not going to quite get the sound pressure levels you want. And the other trouble with the NXT thing is it's like a hemispherical radiator. It just goes everywhere. So that you're going to have a lot more better acoustic treatment in the cinema to soak up the wave you don't want, to improve the intelligibility for the people in the audience. And that is one advantage of horns and things, that you can aim them exactly where you want them to be, by and large. So just to digress, there was some little bowling alley type thing, literally, because it was a very old cinema and they just divided the bottom bit up into two bowling alleys. They put a floor over. So that what was the balcony is now the floor of the new cinema with the same big screen there. The stalls had been divided up into two bowling alley things, and they were getting a lot of intelligibility problems. So Scott Tricks and myself thought, let's just turn the horn through 90 degrees and bolt it in there. So it was doing 90 degrees this way, 40 degrees that way. There'll be a lot less splash off the sidewalls, and the intelligibility will improve, which it did. Mm. So that's one solution, is to just move away a bit from their old 90 by 40 tradition of, they're around, they're cheap, let's use them. And the industry has been doing that for 40 or 50 years, to try and have a slightly more tailored range of directivity, main beam angle stuff for cinemas.
It's a bit off the wall, but we move the frequency up several decades, and you come to what is called the patch antenna, which by driving it at particular points, you could establish different directivity and polarisation characteristics. So is there a way of having a patch membrane that you can excite.
Yeah, I think the trouble is if it's not the full size of the screen, some of the screens we're talking about are like 25 metres across by 8 or 9 metres high. You're going to see the join lines, you see.
But you can have possibly a continuous membrane, but which is driven discreetly at appropriate points.
Mm. But then are you going to see the sag in the membrane where the thing's fastened to it, you know?
Well,
at
the high frequencies, the displacement is going to be small, localized but small, because of the amount of energy. At low frequencies, it's going to involve a much greater area of the screen, and the displacement will then be small as well.
Mm. Yeah, oh yeah, well, I think
so
we'll get back.
Into the patent office and register a provisional.
What's the difference compared to a conventional speaker system? What's the narrowest
bit? Anyway, sorry, you had a question.
Just following up on the X-curve factor you were talking before, given that the screen introduces a frequency roll-off as well,
yes.
Does that mean that the sound system that you're designing behind the screen is fundamentally flat, and you allow the screen to do that roll-off?
More or less, yeah. Mm. I mean, I sort of just follow what the native compression driver is doing, and most of the little boxes that you get for doing cinema equalization have got a little box that you tick to go screen EQ, click, and then you can select a frequency and select a boost, and all it does is put a Sheldon filter in to compensate for whatever you think the screen is going to do. And similarly, of course, you realize that horn-loaded compression drivers have got sort of a piston range, and then they fall off because the moving masses can be represented in a circuit by an inductor, and the throat of the horn is a resistance, and so you've got a first order crossover happening at about, you know, say 5 kHz for 4-inch titanium compression drivers and 6 or 7 or 8 kHz for smaller compression drivers. So there's an inherent horn, CD horn roll-off, as they call it. So you need another little shelving EQ with a button and a click switch for that as well, or you try and do it passively, which it gets a bit messy. Because, you know, ultimately you've got only, you know, say 100 dB per watt per meter sensitivity at the high end of the compression driver, and unless you want to put in a step down transformer and have a 1 ohm load for the amplifiers, you can't get much more out of it than what the compression driver can do as it's sort of rolling off into the dirt. Yeah.
Have you ever been able to design a cinema and have the speakers exposed, actually see the speakers, not buried behind screens? Where you've got a cinema owner that has a passion for the sound, you have to.
No, not really. Most of them.
Well, in a live show, you know, we see the speakers.
Yes.
We see the boxes. We see the horns. We see everything.
Well, the trouble is, movies come in different aspect ratios, and they often bring masking in on the sides. So, you know, either you have the speakers well outside the masking thing, in which case they're at the corners of the room because the screen's usually the full width of the room, or you've got to have them inside the masking for the smallest aspect ratio of narrowest screen. I mean, some cinemas actually change the aspect ratio by doing this. Most of them just do it this way.
Yeah.
So you've got to allow for the different, different countries and even different production houses choose different ratios. And none of it's the same as the 16:9 of a high definition TV, for example. That's yet another, standard that's grown up over the years for aspect ratio. So yeah, it gets quite complicated trying to. In fact, I got a service call. I've equalised quite a few of our horn systems in South Korea, you see. And I got a service call to go back to one. So we get in our little van in the middle of the night and go rattling across, South Korea. Get to this thing about 2 a.m. after the last show's finished, and the projector's, oh, you're very worried, very worried. So I put a bit of Rebecca Pigeon on. Sure enough, she sounded a bit muffled and stuff. And then I looked and thought, this masking's in. Pull the masking back. Marvellous, it works. And the people who supplied the masking thing, you're supposed to provide acoustically transparent black curtain, but this was some black shit they'd got from somewhere. And they doubled it over and put a big bit of wood in there, and that was obscuring the horns. Surprise, surprise. Things sounded a bit muffled, So accidents like that happen as well. So I wrote back to our agents in Korea, I wrote a terse little note. Here's a quote from the Dolby manual which says, side masking shall be acoustically transparent and not be doubled over, and please forward this to your suppliers. kick their ass accordingly. So he did. But yes, there's funny things like that happen too. That, you know, I equalised the speakers and been there before they put the mask in. You know, they were still nailing up stuff in the foyer and doing all this sort of business. And then after they put the masking in, and it was the wrong stuff. Duh. But yes, I think the chief projectionist was happy once we'd found what the fault was. And he could then adjust things accordingly. But yes, have some adventures in the cinema world, I must admit. Mainly doing stuff in the middle of the night or the very early hours of the morning when the cinema's free, because they're not going to close it down so they won't lose revenue either. Which is one of the reasons why, you know, getting a shallower and shallower depth between the screen and the back wall means you can put another row of seats in, thank you very much. They're not silly. Well, and? Yeah, so. Great.
Sorry. I was going to say that this problem with the screen has been reincarnated with the modern TV sets where the speakers are behind the screen and there's no movement.
Yes. Well, this new improved picture technology means that the whole thing's about this thick or something, isn't it? So
it's
there is no
room left for the speakers.
Exactly.
So they fire through the screen, it's quite effective.
Oh, well, there you go.
Is it most people, when they go and buy a widescreen TV, they have to listen to the sound occasionally, just not the picture?
Yes.
You don't listen to the sound in the shop, do you?
Well, if you could try, I don't think it would make a loud enough sound to be able to hear in a shop, quite frankly. But yes, it's a bit of a problem with the modern displays. They're now becoming displays that are a TV set, and you've got to then find a sound system to go with them as well. Yeah. Sorry.
I've been in a couple of cinemas that have had Crick speakers
down the surround
speakers, which have generally been relatively small boxes.
Yes.
I mean, how would the size of those compare to those behind the screen? And do you ever use any front speakers for low frequency energy for surrounds?
No, I think that the original purpose of surrounds was to add ambience. And so originally they were just mono, and you just had a bit of background ambience and stuff, and that helped the general illusion of whatever the people were trying to get across. Then they thought, oh, maybe we can have stereo surrounds, and so now the idea still is that you can't tell where the sound is coming from with surrounds. So they're supposed to be closely enough spaced together and sufficiently high so that you get a diffuse field, and it's just ambience. Trouble is now that, of course, 5.1 and 7.1 music type stuff has come along, and people think, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we could get 5.1 effects or 7.1 effects in a cinema? And so they're now starting to partition the surrounds up into sub-arrays, if you like. But the problem is still there, that there's a row of them and you still can't localise very well, especially if it's behind you a bit. But by and large, the surrounds, I think, go down to about 80 hertz or something like that, because anything else is fed off to the low frequency effects channel, you know, by design. In this is the movie standard, if you like.
Originally, those the surround or audience participation speakers came off a single channel, which was switched by a control tone. And it wasn't until we got to the 5.1 that actually allowed you to do less than
well,
right
Dolby hand. Figured out how to do the what is the Dolby analog surround sound.
Where
you
remember that the
eight-inch, ten-inch.
It seems to be very narrow.
Yeah, well, they're angled usually, and there's usually an eight-inch or a ten-inch speaker in there, depending on how.
Just one driver.
Sort of tweeter.
Not
for commercial cinema, they're not. I think the dipole idea has sort of died a bit, because dipoles only work for the one plane of audience members who are in the null. Everybody else, where's that coming from? Because they're not in the null anymore. So while that was a good idea from Mr. THX, in fact, you know, we've gone back to the old-fashioned way of surrounds now, having direct radiators, but a lot of them.
Rear speakers.
Same with the rears, yeah. I mean, a home setup is really single sides and single rears, either for at the 5.1 angle, or I can't go back far enough, can I? Either that angle and that angle, or just the 5.1 one. But most domestic living rooms wouldn't have enough room in them to have a full 7.1 system with back surround left and right, side surround left and right, and then the centre left, centre right. So it's a bit of a squeeze, really.
You mentioned the Japanese are working on, what is it, 22?
22.2, yeah. That's for total immersion.
But there's still only a single dialogue speaker?
Oh, I think there's two, top and bottom of the screen, because the screen's solid, in their demonstration systems anyway. Mm.
But yeah, still, there's a single exit, the dialogue shall never move from the centre.
Well, because people who are sitting off, they still want to hear it coming from where the, you know, the cameraman's put the face in the centre of the screen, because that's who's talking, and you want to still hear it coming from there.
But so all the dialogue, the convention came that all the dialogue was centre screen. But you had things like Cinerama or early CinemaScope that actually used three-channel dialogue which followed, but what they found is
too hard to edit.
It was just too much trouble in editing to deal with that.
Not sure about that, because mostly movies have, I'm sorry to disillusion you, but the sound that you hear in a movie, none of it actually happened when the picture was made. It's all been put in afterwards, either as special effects or as voiceovers in a voiceover booth. And a movie soundtrack is about, I don't know, 128 tracks or something by the time they mix it down into stubs for special effects and for music and for dialogue and so on. And then I think from that point, yeah, you'd want to make sure that the dialogue was is still only a mono channel. Or I don't think that would be in stereo.
European, just because of they never use production sound, or very rarely use production sound dialogue, and it's invariably done. But there's still a fair amount of movies that use production sound, and Good Night and Good Luck is a case in point, which was basically all production sound, and production sound needs to go a solo credit falls down. Because of the, but yeah, there were the TV, which runs on the same constraints in surround, is almost invariably using production sound rather than ADR for dialogue.
Oh, sorry, Jim.
With the, you described the speaker systems using a three-way behind screen, four-way, three off. What do you do for the LFE speakers?
Oh, we have 400 litre boxes with a couple of 18s in them, times as many as you like, you know. preferably selling them in twos, fours, eights. I think one cinema around the place has got 16 of them in a row, which means you could shake the whole building apart, but I don't know that they ever try to do that. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story if you don't repeat it to too many people. A guy called Peter Williams, who works for Greater Union, is a bass freak, you see. And when we were redoing the George Street 1 and 2, you know, there's two cinemas between George Street and Kent Street in Sydney, and he wanted to make sure he had enough bass. So I think we've got 8 double 18 subwoofers across the under the screen to make sure there's enough bass there and stuff. And he wanted to make a really, really sure he could get his 113 dB Dolby level. So I sort of was using one of my measurement microphones and winding the pink noise up, and it saturated because it's not meant for that sort of thing. So Scott and Peter went down there with a sound pressure level meter, and I'm winding the sound up and getting to 105, 106, 107, and the bio box window's rattling, and I'm thinking 108, 109, 110, 111, and poof, the whole rack of amplifiers dropped off the air because it was trying to draw too much power from the mains. So God knows how many kilowatts was going into it, but it was a lot. And he said, oh, well, I suppose 111 is close enough.
You must have had an early experience with Sensor.
Could have been, yeah.
So you're using bass management off all of the channels feed into the LFE?
Well, not really. That's done. That's done when they make create the thing.
Yeah.
All a cinema system is it just takes whatever the cinema processor says is left, centre, right, LFE, surrounds or whatever, and puts them through the amplifiers and out again. I mean, there might be a multi-channel equaliser thing there that you can do the equalising for each of the channels individually, but essentially it's just and a volume control, but it's linear thereafter. And, you know, any LFE types. I mean, strictly speaking, you shouldn't need the LFE channel unless you've got LFE, like an explosion or something. Mostly the screen speakers are supposed to be full range, that is down to about 40 hertz, which is, you know, quite reasonable. And then if there's anything lower than that or some pretty loud explosions that are going to wreck screen speakers, well then that's what you've got LFEs for. When you channel, most of the energy would go into the LFE and not, they would then protect the screen speakers by not, and the surrounds, by not feeding it in there. But that's done at the creation of the film stage, not at the playback stage.
Yeah, I have a problem with LFE, basically more in PA type applications, and the problem that I find is that most of the digital processors or the speaker management systems, if you take ones that are affordable like the DBX260 or the XDA, they've got the highest order of high pass filtering that you can do is only fourth order. So, and the problem with that is that, well, you put that in as a speaker protection system to avoid failure from over excursion. But then on top of that, when they install the system, they've got an overlay curve, which is a room EQ. And the room EQ goes over the top and corrects for your roll off.
Yes.
So virtually you've got no speaker protection. Now we're feeding 2 kilowatts in the cabin. It's
shaking
around
a
dangerous situation that I find is, and I'm about to write to and say, well, I don't believe that their processors have sufficiently high enough smokes to protect the drivers.
Yeah, I think fourth order ought to be high enough. But as you say, if somebody's trying to do real-time EQ and use the full amount of the fader at 31 hertz or something.
But you've got a graphic equaliser that's got 15 dB boost at 30. I've rolled it off. I want it stopped at 30 because the cone excursion is 20 millimetres peak frequency. It's 40 hertz. We're talking feeding a kilowatt in, 40 hertz roll-off minus 3 dB. A cone excursion at 20 hertz is going to be about 20 millimetres one way. Damage to the speaker. I've got to shut that off. I want a brick wall filter in there. And because the person has got a graphic equalizer, he's got a ring cue on the top of it.
Well, you probably have a bit more education of the users of the thing to say, look, you know. Anyway, we're getting a bit away from it. Any other questions related to design of loudspeakers? Sorry,
The nonsense that one more about grips. They talk about all these issues with the loudspeaker selection how does grips get involved? Is it most of your commissioning staff get the similar chains? All the engineers from the beginning to the
Yeah, I mean, Scott Crick's got involved back in the 1980s refurbishing one of the cinemas in a privately owned cinema in Adelaide. And then I think he did a couple for Greater Union and so on and so forth. And the business has grown over the last however long it is since 1984 or thereabouts, to the point where I guess the major cinema chains and quite a few of the individual ones would come to us if they want to at least get some sort of quote for how much the loudspeakers are going to cost for their new cinema complexes and stuff. And as I think I said, I've got this jazzy little spreadsheet that I can just put the dimensions of the cinema in and then plug in the numbers for the different Crick systems until I get a little green light or a green tick that says, yeah, this one won't catch fire, you know. So when they thrash it sort of thing, and then also tells me the actual power that I need in the amplifiers and stuff for the individual bits and pieces. So effectively it's the design of the B-chain system, as they call it, you know, from the top of the volume control onwards, the power amps and crossovers and so on and so forth. And I guess, you know, we've been just doing it for an awfully long time, that's all. By and large, until I came on the scene about 15 years ago, Crick's used other people's horns for the top end. And I've spent, you know, more years of my life than I care to remember doing, you know, firstly using MathCAD to try and design a horn and then using ANSYS, which was another pain in the whatever. As a finite element analysis simulator thing, and then more recently using a program called Comsol, which is a lot easier to use because it's a Windows-based thing. ANSYS was sort of tarted up DOS put into Windows, and its basis was back with Fortran, thank you very much. So if you ever wrote a script and it didn't quite work somewhere, you'd go and look up your Fortran manual to find out what syntax you're supposed to have used in order to get it to work properly. Anyway, I digress. But yeah, I guess Crick's have been in the cinema business for a long, long time, and most people around Australia know us, and for that matter, overseas as well. So it's gratifying.
Competition.
Well, the competition comes from people, I suppose, like JBL, used to be EAW, but I think they've pulled out of the market. Electrovoice, I think, are pretty quiet now. There's still a few major, some of the major PA players also have a cinema chain of line. QSC, I think, try and make all the amplifiers and stuff and also try and flog off a line of cinema speakers.
Dantec?
Altec. Altec? No, they've long gone. They're absorbed in Altec Lansing, absorbed in JB Lansing, absorbed in Harman International, if you want the potted story. But our competition often is the fact that there are two or three manufacturers worldwide who put together really, really cheap junk. And if someone is trying to do a really, really cheap job, then they'll probably go and buy those, and good luck to them. They'll have lots of service calls and trouble. But at least I think one of the things we are quietly proud of is if we've specified a cinema or specified what speakers they need for a cinema, that's it. We don't hear any more from them for the next 25 years until they come back to want a refit or something. So we design the stuff that's got enough reserve of capability and power handling and all that other sort of business. Or we issue them very stern warnings. I don't know that we've actually ever refused a sale, but because money is money after all. But certainly we've had to do a fair bit of argy-bargy with some owners who want to really use this sort of thing behind the screen and wonder why it's not going to work. And more recently we're getting into the high-end home cinema people who've got $500,000 to spare and want a super duper listening room home cinema experience, and again hi-fi speakers, even the best and the biggest of them still can't quite make enough sound pressure level out far enough for someone who's got a 10 meter room with plush armchairs and second row of armchairs and all that sort of business. So I'm sort of gooching up some of our smaller cinema systems to, with a flatter response rather than the X-curve roll-off and stuff. And they seem to be quite well received, actually. The average PA box is appalling, I think, compared to the sort of stuff that we can do with a fairly good quality 15-inch and a fairly good quality horn, and a very good crossover. I've had more components in my crossovers than you'd see in 10, well not 10, I'd have third order bass roll-offs and fourth order high frequency roll-offs and all sorts of twiddlies and thingies in order to get a good flat response and a good matching at the crossover frequency and the main lobe out the front rather than pointing up or down or every which way. So if you take a bit of care over the product, then it sells itself almost. Rod, you've had a fair go. Rod's
still. You've been talking about the end of the chain. You referred also to the beginning of the chain. So do you have a supply system to report to you that's actually going to go into the forms?
I needed the Film Corp recently, but there they are. I think recording, as in music recording studios, is a different sort of a...
No, not music recording, I'm talking about the film mix studios.
Well, so how many are there in Australia? I think we provided speakers to the Fox Studios originally in Sydney, but I don't know what's happened to them. I think they've closed. As you say, you guys
sound
got
firm.
One.
Sound firm.
Okay.
I saw a film yesterday with Sapphires. Recommended because film.
Yeah. The Film Corp's got two identical rooms. One's got 90 seats in it, and it's a showing type cinema, and the other one's got a Socking Great Harrison mixing desk in it and a couple of nice armchairs in the front.
Roger mixes in a complete small cinema.
In PA design, they've gone away from the individual components into line array type structures.
Yeah.
Has that been considered for cinema?
It's too expensive. Each line array box has got about, 5 or 10 degrees vertical coverage angle, so you're going to need 8 of them to get 40 degrees coverage. Times 3 is 24. It's an awful lot of boxes compared to just, 3 horns and 3 boxes. So I think line arrays often are too wide. They're 150 degrees, 120 degrees wide, so there's too much splash on the sidewalls. Line arrays have got their purpose for large venues where you want a considerable amount of angular coverage, and then you just stack enough line array elements up to get the vertical coverage for whatever shape arena it is really where they shine. And when you've got an awful lot of line arrays, you can get a fair bit of acoustic horsepower going out, more than you can with just a stack of horns and stuff. And it's all from the same sort of point source too. If you have an array of horns, then there's, with the best will in the world, there's going to be some little gaps or some little overlaps where there's frequency combing. And they're not all the same point source either, so you've got to try and time align them a little bit, except that you can't because they're not in the same physical point in space. But time align them for all of the widespread of audience. So it's quite difficult, you know, getting some high power stuff. In fact, there was an AES paper a few years ago by Zavinsky from Sirwin Vega, and he was complaining because with very large powerful arrays, where they're making like 150, 160 dB immediately in front of the array, the air was distorting and ruining the sound quality, you know. Because, I mean, you know, 100, 140 dB is what exists under the dome of a compression driver, you know, or 145 dB at 1 watt. So it gets pretty loud underneath, inside a compression driver, at the throat of a horn. And for those of you who are interested, if this is atmospheric pressure, then a sine wave up and a sine wave down to a vacuum and back again is 195 dB sound pressure. You know, for your store of trivia. And space shuttle would make a couple of hundred dB, but then that's going over atmosphere and down to a vacuum.
Has the temperature in the cinema changed the same?
A little bit, but mostly they're air conditioned.
All day, lots of people, of course.
Yeah, I don't think the venue's far enough. I know in live sound things, the heat of the audience and the humidity of the audience changes the sound and tends to sort of beam it away from the back of the audience. So they've got to allow for that sort of thing in, you know, huge outdoor concerts and the like. But cinemas are by and large too small and too well controlled with, you know, air conditioning, getting rid of the humidity and keeping the temperature reasonably constant. So in a way, I'm lucky I've been designing for cinemas because it's a pretty benign environment, really. You know, the maximum levels are pretty well controlled and the temperature and humidity are pretty well controlled. And, you know, once you've specified it properly for the size of the venue, you know. So, any more questions? You sure? Going, gone?
Okay, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. I think that closes the meeting. Thanks everyone for coming.